I'm Cara Sofoco. I'm the communications director at an organisation called Some of Us, and I'm not an education policy expert, but luckily we have three people with really interesting range of experience on the panel today. So we have Dr. Faiza Shaheen, who is head of the class think tank. We've got Holly Rigby, who is a teacher at a South London secondary school, an academy school, I think. And we've got Professor Danny Dorling, who's an inequality expert and has lots of very interesting things to say about schools and the divide between rich and poor people. So I'm going to give a really quick introduction, but I'm sure you all know as much as I do because I'm not an education policy expert. It's been a bit of a weird year for education policy. We had an education bill, which the current Tory government introduced, but then a different part of the Tory government have recently scrapped. We're apparently going to see the return of grammar schools, which I imagine isn't a particularly popular policy with many people here. And yeah, we've seen a new education secretary and what looks like a new agenda for our schools and young people. So to help us understand a bit about what's going on, but also about the really unique role that schools and education policy play in driving and reducing inequality, we've got our three speakers. And I'm just going to hand over to them. I think Faiza, you're going to go first. And to give us a bit more of a sense of what's going on, what we can expect, and what a different education system might look like.
Great. Faiza? Thank you. Okay, we don't have mics, so I'm just going to stand and shout. You're going to get fed up of seeing me today. I'm filling in some sessions where, unfortunately, a couple of people couldn't make it. I have done some work on education, and something that really struck me late recently, and I'm giving you these stats a week early, so you're not going to be surprised next week when you see it on TV. I just finished doing a documentary with the BBC looking at it looked at whether we're ever going to see a black prime minister. But we looked at the different hurdles that different groups have to face along the way. And education, of course, is a big part of that. It reminded me, of course, of the prime ministers. 75% of our prime ministers to date went to Oxford or Cambridge. So let's remember how important those early years are in terms of leadership and getting in those top positions, whether it be our MPs, whether it be in business, and whether it be in our judicial system and our media. And I think it's a really important subject. There's a parallel session on the 1% where hopefully they're going to deep dive on that. So I looked into the education numbers. I did some analysis of the numbers that have come out of the Department of Education. And it really struck me after years of not really looking at the topic, sort of 10 years or so that I hadn't really been involved as I was in the start of my career, but how big that gap still is, whether you look by income, whether you look by geography. In fact, by geography, where you live seems to matter more now than it did 10 years ago. By race, and so this was really interesting, we cut the data looking at, in particular, who gets 3 A's at A-level as being an unfortunate hurdle to going towards being Prime Minister. And we found that it's really important for the gap. So if you look at state-educated white and state-educated black children, so that's black African, black Caribbean, black mixed, which historically have been a group of kids that haven't done as well at school but actually have started performing much better in the last 5 years or so, 4% of black children will get 3 A's at A-level. You take that to state white and it becomes about 7-8%. Now the biggest difference was not between black and white. Privately educated kids, 28% of privately educated, I don't want to be an advert for private school, but 28% of privately educated kids will get 3 A's. When you look at what that means then to Oxbridge and those big universities that we might not want it this way, but this is the system right now, still, despite all the talk of tackling educational inequalities, making sure that we give opportunities for all kids, still pretty much the same number of kids going to Oxford and Cambridge from Eton. Pretty much the same. About a third of a year will go in any 1 year. So it just really struck me how ingrained these inequalities are. And for me, as someone that's worked much more now on income inequality and wealth inequalities, of course, how are we going to start tackling the gap in education and that attainment gap without understanding the role that the gap in incomes is playing, the incomes and wealth? Mm-hmm. Of course, why is it that the top private schools have seen their fees triple? They're charging triple what they did 10, 15 years ago. They can do that because, you know, the rich have got that much richer to be able to afford it. So how difficult it is for those at the bottom, the schools, state schools, to kind of be racing to make up that difference when the top, because they are so much richer and they can invest so much more, is even going further away. Now you can imagine my frustration then after having cut these numbers and looked at them over the summer when I heard the announcement on grammar schools. I mean, it's absolutely outrageous, apart from the fact of personally feeling I don't like the idea of being divided at that young age, either by religion or by into grammar schools, whether by attainment at this 11 plus age. So that there's no evidence to support that it helps lower the educational attainment gap. There's just no evidence for it. There wasn't evidence then, and there isn't evidence now. You know, the only answer I could find for that real commitment to wanting to and drive to get more grammar schools was that when I looked at the composition of who's in government, and I was looking because of that BBC documentary at the composition of cabinets over the years, and of course we had a cabinet under Cameron that was very, very private school. This cabinet is very grammar school. But it doesn't seem right that just because you had an experience you have to put it on everyone else. And so apart from that, there's no evidence at all, and I'm sure others here will talk about that. I was really just going to start it there, but just to kind of warm up to the... it's amazing we've got a teacher here speaking, and Danny Dorling. But to me, where I look at where education inequalities have fallen, so London in particular, that is to do with real investment in the comprehensive system. That is to do with schools helping each other, coming together, giving each other advice. And that is to do with what we tell our children they're able to achieve. So there was something that was really important to the story, and you'll see it's a documentary, it's out next Sunday, at, I think it's on at 8 or 9 p.m. What's striking is what children are told at a young age and what difference that makes. Now in London, because of the big ethnic population here and the way in which that plays into aspirations, that has really helped educational inequalities fall in London. So as we look forward, and I know Danny's going to talk a lot about what we do going forward, I think that's what we need to cling to. Thank you.
Thank you, Pfizer. Depressing start. That was really interesting about the 3 A's at A-level.
And in fact, I should say, and this is the most troubling stat actually for me, was that as a black boy, you're more likely to be excluded from school than get 3 A's at A-level. I mean, that really makes me upset that is still the case.
Thing. So even more. And now for someone who I guess really sees this on the front line, and I'm not sure how long you've been teaching, but I imagine you've been on the receiving end a lot of the various education policies that do often seem to have been introduced based on the Secretary of State's personal experience of school, which I'm sure is the best way to make policy. We've got Holly Rickley, who's an activist and teacher at the Globe Academy in South London. So I'm just going to hand straight over to you to tell us a bit about where it looks like from where you sit.
Thank you. Good morning. As I said there, I teach at the ARC Globe Academy. I am not here representing the views of the ARC Globe Academy today, just to be absolutely clear about that. But yeah, I'm a secondary school English teacher. I've been teaching for 4 years. I'm also in charge of teacher training in my school. I have many different ideas about academies, but we actually featured in the documentary that was spoken about there, because we are seen as a school that is trying to address this kind of inequality gap. So I do have some big fundamental problems with academies, which I'm going to talk about today, but if I'm talking about my own experience, I'm actually very proud of the work that we do in our school. I work with very inspiring young people and some great colleagues as well. So I think it's a mixed picture in London that might not be representative necessarily of the whole of the UK, but I'm going to speak about London particularly. Yeah, it's nice to speak to you today, because my day job normally, I might be heckled by teenagers if I stood up to speak, and you look like quite a compliant audience, which it's a good start already compared to what I normally do when I wake up in the morning. And also, like I said, thank you very much to class for inviting me to speak, because if there's one thing the Tories don't do, it's ask teachers very often what they actually think. So it's quite nice. I'm like, yes, I get to like share my ideas now, which is awesome. So there are many things to talk about, and I think that for me the most important thing that we need to talk about as progressives is, what do we truly think is the purpose of education? Why do we think a comprehensive state education is important? And the problem with academisation, and the problem with the what I call the teach firstification of the teaching profession, where training teachers has been removed from universities and put into schools, is that what you get is now, and I myself am a product of that, so I'll hold my hands up to that, but what you get is teachers who become excellent deliverers of content, excellent kind of in how to teach, but very little do we talk about what we are teaching or why we are teaching. And that makes it, without any kind of historical knowledge of educational policy, without any understanding of how your practice fits into pedagogy more generally, what you see now is that it's very easy for academies to kind of enforce their quite market-driven corporate ideology on teachers who just say, oh, well, you know, it's for the good of the children, so, you know, let's go, basically. And without that kind of critical analysis that you get from a university experience, I think we're not asking ourselves enough questions about why we're teaching and what we're teaching. So that's clear to me in quite a few ways in my school. As I said, I love my school, I love my job, I have one of the best jobs in the world as far as I'm concerned. But in my school, the biggest problem that I see is what we're teaching our young children and our young people about the purpose of education. And it's become that the purpose of education is for you to become a worker, for you to become a productive workforce, right? And this is clear in my school. So we have, instead of parents' evening, we now have student performance appraisal meetings to get them ready to be employees in the world of work. Instead of having kind of like honesty or kindness as our school motto, one of our school mottos is professionalism. And, you know, students are regularly put into internal exclusion for like not having a tie, not having their top button done up. Although one of my best moments ever in teaching was the boy who said to my head teacher, but so I was watching House of Commons the other day and the leader of the Labour Party doesn't have his top button done up. Another reason why Jeremy Corbyn is so great, because kids can say that now, like with kind of some validity. So yeah, it's things like this. You know, we have posters like put up in our school recently that linked explicitly your outcomes and your attainment at GCSE to your salary and the job that you're expected to get, as if that's the only reason why we educate. And I kind of didn't really have the heart to tell them that I got all A's at A level and I don't earn £100,000 a year. Like it's kind of not even true, and that's what's the worst thing about it is, not only is it the wrong idea that the values are wrong, it's not actually even true that that's the case. So I think that what we need really is like a radically new agenda, a radically new conversation about why we're teaching our young people. And from my perspective, education is fundamental to the workings of a functioning democracy. You cannot have a democracy without an educated population. And I think that for me, it's about creating critically minded, active students. I want every young person in my class to be able to read a broadsheet newspaper, to be able to have the numeracy, to actually be able to hold a Chancellor's budget to account, right? Those are the things that we need if we're going to have a democracy. And I think that we cannot claim to live in a democracy in this country when lots of our young people go through 11 years of comprehensive education and they leave without 5 good GCSEs, including English and maths. That is still 40% of our country. Half of our prison population has a reading age under the age of 10 years old. That is not a democracy. We cannot claim to live in a democracy until we've dealt with those things. And, you know, I want our young people to be informed and to be able to make informed decisions about the things that are important to them. And we need to tell them that that's why we educate, because it is fundamental to democracy. And, I mean, I'll be disappointed if they all become Tories at the end of that process, but at least they'll be informed Tories, yeah, which might be a contradiction in terms. But, you know, they at the very least, they'll be able to make some real decisions about what matters to them. So if we do agree that, that democracy is important to the purpose of education, then there are other hurdles, I think, when it comes to inequality in schools that we have to face. It's very easy to become evangelical about teaching. I mean, I teach, so obviously I think that education can have a profound effect on the lives of our young people. But we need to look at the intersection of education with housing, with poverty, and with mental health in this country, because education alone is not going to solve some of the problems that we're facing currently for our young people. For me, this was highlighted particularly in the case of one of my students, a young man called Mohammed Jira Ray. I taught in year 10 and year 11, an incredibly troubled young man, but teachers in the room will know when you see that intelligent spark behind the eyes, you know that it's there. A wonderful young person, and had a very chaotic life outside of school. 85% of the students in my school qualify for free school meals, which means that your total family income for the whole family is under £16,000 a year. For the whole family, right? So that's 85% of the kids in my school. Mohammed Jira Ray qualified for free school meals, so with that marker of poverty. His mother suffered from mental health issues. I work in Southwark, which has the highest number of mental health cases in the whole borough, chronically underfunded, as are all mental health services, I think, across the country now. And not only that, but his family is under threat from eviction from the Aylesbury estate, which is just down the road from the old Haygate. I don't know if anyone knows South East London, but we're going through a very rapid process of gentrification at the moment, and his family is under threat of eviction. So when he left in the summer 18 months ago, he had been permanently excluded many, many times. He left without any GCSEs. And I remember turning to my colleague and I said, like, what does life for Mohammed Jira Ray look like when you leave school? Without any options, without any alternatives. 3 months later, he was actually found stabbed and killed on the playground next to school. And a victim of the gang violence that blights our communities. It's still definitely affects me today. And I think one thing that we need to make absolutely clear is that that young man's only crime is being poor and black and growing up in South East London, right? And that's not, that can't be happening. Like, it's not okay that is still happening today. And that gang violence, which is perpetuated by poverty, is perpetuated by the housing situation. It's just so shocking. And so there is so much work to be done. There is so much work to be done. We cannot have more Mohammed Jira Rays. That is, of course, a more extreme case. But there are many young people who leave school without the opportunities, without the futures that we know that they all deserve. So what does that mean then? We know this inequality is there. We know that it must be addressed. And it's for Mohammed and other young people that I still am teaching today and still very proud of my profession. And yes, education drives inequality. That is the title of the session we're looking at today. But it can also be a force for change. I've seen it in my own school. I see how you can change the life chances of the young people. And yes, we need to challenge the Tories on the policies that they are putting forward at the moment, which are completely irrelevant most of the time to whatever is happening in schools. But whilst challenging the Tories, we need to be passionate about our vision as well. We need to say, what do we stand for as progressives who believe in education? What do we want our education service to look like? And for me, actually, in many ways, this is an incredibly exciting time. As a socialist, as a proud new member of the Labour Party, I'm very excited because having never been involved in a political organisation before, we now have a leader of the Labour Party in Jeremy Corbyn. We have Angela Rayner, who just is a wonderful person who actually seems to care about young people, which is amazing. You would think that would be like the kind of, you had to do that to be the Education Secretary, but we know that that's not the case. We've had Michael Gove and Trish Ram Hunt before him wasn't much better. So I'm very excited about Jeremy Corbyn and Angela Rayner. And, you know, I welcome their campaign against grammar schools. As you said, there is no evidence that supports it. But we have to be honest with ourselves. Working class families, if you gave them the choice, would send their child to a grammar school, because the perception of grammar schools, in, as far as I can see in my own community, that might not be the case across the board, but in my community, aspirational families, they see grammar schools as the way to success. That is why the Tories are doing it, as far as I'm concerned. That seems to be an ideology which they've been able to promote, that if you know, you work hard, working class family, you go to a grammar school, you can succeed. You'll be that, you know, that apple that rises up, right? And so we have to be honest about that. And we need to offer a better alternative. We can't just say that grammar schools don't work. Mm. We've got to say our schools are better, and that we are going to offer your children something better. And What I think is that, and there's lots of debates we had about this as well, as I said, about what we should be teaching. Just like grammar schools, we should be teaching the classics still. I want my young people to be able to read the poetry of William Blake and compare it to the lyrics of Dizzy Rascal. I want my young people to know Isaac Newton and to also be able to know Ben Goldacre's Bad Science, to be able to know the greatest things we've achieved in this, as it, you know, in this country, but also the horrors of the British Empire. We need to have that rigour in our curriculum and not shy away from having that whilst also drawing on the very real, the very inspiring life experiences and stories of the young people that sit in front of us. So, this is not to make kind of Eton cardboard cut-out copies, but to say that actually our young people will be better as a result of being able to move between both worlds. We know that is what our politicians can't do. They live in this world of their Eton bubble, and I want my young people to be able to stand there and hold their own talking about Shakespeare, but also be able to say why South East London is important and the culture that they have there is important too. So, I have been asked to finish, and so I will be wrapping up. But yeah, my vision is not that different from Jeremy Corbyn's and Angela Rayner. We need a national education service. We need more investment in the arts, particularly in schools. As an English teacher, I feel very passionately about that. We need power back in the hands of our teachers and our parents and our young people. I'm very blessed to work with young people every day that I find so inspiring. I have wonderful colleagues who are passionate, who are driven, and I have absolutely no doubt that we have the human capacity to really transform our education system to make something more progressive. But we need to ask the right questions. We need to come together. But at this point, I'm quite excited at the prospect. So thank you.
Thank you, Holly. That was really, really interesting. And I'm going to hand over, everyone, get your questions ready, points for discussion. We've got plenty of time for Q&A. I saw some people, maybe other people in education, kind of nodding at certain points. So after Danny Dorling, we're going to open it up, and really excited to hear all of your thoughts and comments. And yeah, so now over to Danny. He's a professor of geography at the University of Oxford and has written, I think, maybe a dozen books about different areas of inequality and social inequality.
Thank you. It's great to follow those two. I'm going to refer to what was said in those two talks. Of course, I don't speak on behalf of Oxford University. I should point out. Well, I was pondering that, because Oxford's been around for a long time, and the only people you ever remember speaking in the past from Oxford were actually people saying things which were not the agreement of most of Oxford University. So on education, it's Tawney in the 1930s who said we should educate for all. That is the only person you remember from the 1920s and 30s from Oxford. Things do change, and they only change because people say that what we currently have is wrong. It is not hard to say that what we currently have is wrong because it is so extreme. The figures are hard to come by, but our exclusion rates are almost certainly the highest in Europe, and they're much higher than when I was a child. In other European countries, you would exclude far fewer children. Our children are also less violent than they were when I was a child, so there isn't some epidemic of violence that means we need to exclude. In other countries, when a child is excluded, normally because of violence, the agent of the state comes and collects them from the school and takes them to the school they're going to go to on the same day. That is normal European behaviour. We are not a normal European country. We have amongst the worst results in Western Europe when you test our children at age 24. We're not that bad at age 15 or 16 because we teach people to pass exams. When you test them again at 24, we are at the bottom. 3 A's simply means you have been taught to get A's at an A level. It doesn't mean you're good at geography or maths or English. And that is very, very hard to get your head around if you've grown up in Britain. Because we have become so used to the idea that an A or an A star, it's a bit like the Americans with their GPA scores. All countries that are very bad at education believe in exam numbers very highly. Countries which are good at education, which produce young adults who are numerate and literate and can solve problems because you can test them and they can later, and who become engineers and invent things, those countries are not hung up about A stars and ones. It is very different in this country. You both mentioned Eton, so I thought I'd start off with the private sector. We ought to look more at our private sector, A, because we have one. Most of Europe doesn't have a private sector. It is absolutely tiny. We have one. Ours is about 30% of our spending on secondary school. Pupils only, Chile spends more, just 7% of kids. And a set of kids that we don't worry about enough. There already is a grammar school and secondary modern system in our private sector. There are entrance exams. To have got into Eton, you'd have to pass an entrance exam. So there are a whole load of children out there who know they failed their parents when they failed, including exams to get into prep schools and so on. We're running secondary moderns in our towns that parents pay to send their children to. And then when you get into Eton, what is your chance of actually doing what your parents have paid for? It's 1 in 3. 2 out of 3 don't get into Oxford or Cambridge. People at the top of our society are not benefiting from our education system, just as people at the bottom of our society are not. They're being crammed to get these particular marks on these particular days, and it is not good for all of us. I want to talk, in the last few minutes I've got, about where we're going to head to, because I think the left has a problem. Not as big a problem as the right. The right wants to take us back to the 1950s. It wants to do that partly because that is the education that they had. Tim, Theresa's advisor, went to a grammar in Birmingham, thinks it's great, went off to Sheffield. Theresa's parents tried very hard to ensure she never had to go to a school which most other people went to. You look at her educational history. But they also favour talking about grammars, and they're only going to create a few if they actually manage to get it through Parliament, because they know it's popular. And it's popular like Brexit is popular. Popular for very similar reasons to Brexit. And it isn't just people wanting their children to get into a grammar. We are not so innumerate that the majorities 2 years ago in every region of England who wanted grammars didn't understand that their children can't all get into them. It's also, I think, or it has to be, unless people are being very stupid, because some families would actually like a secondary modern, because they're sick of their children being given homework every night to force them to get a C or a B in something that they hate. Whereas a secondary modern would take a bit of that pressure off. And you mustn't underestimate how popular doing something about our schools is, and hence why the Conservatives are playing for it. They're not being stupid, but they're going for the 1950s. Labour is going for the 1970s, which is defend comprehensive schools, which were great. Brilliant intervention. I wouldn't be here if we didn't have comprehensive schools. But it isn't what the left used to do. What the left used to do is talk about what we should do that would be different in future from what we have been doing that would be better. And we did the same with defending council housing. We did the same with defending the NHS. It's all about keep what we had, not what the left used to do, which is can we imagine something better? The problem with comprehensive schools is selection by house price. We didn't used to have selection by house price because the house prices were far more even in our cities until we published school league tables in the 1990s. And after we published school league tables in the 1990s, the slight differences between schools were exacerbated because middle class parents moved towards the area where you got slightly more GCSEs, and then you get a house price gulf. So we have selection, it's by house price. And Labour has to recognise that that exists, and people are angry about it. Because they can work out 4 out of 5 of them cannot afford to live in the area which has the highest prices in a town. So what do you do to get away from it? You do what we've always done with education. You look for things that already exist. We had a comprehensive school on the Isle of Wight in the 1940s, long before we had a comprehensive movement. You look for things that already exist and you slowly advocate to make them widespread. We have 800 cooperative schools in this country already. We have a cooperative academy chain. Cooperative schools do not compete. They cooperate. They have a different ethos. And that's the ethos we need. Otherwise you end up with neighbouring schools talking each other down, spreading rumours about drugs in each school. I know it happens, you know it happens. Excluding pupils who are not going to get the C's or the A's, and we know that happens. If you don't go for cooperation, it's going to get worse. And if you don't go for cooperation, you're not going to get classics being taught. Because you cannot teach classics in every secondary school in a city the size of Oxford. There aren't actually enough kids who want to do it, but also there's other things you have to teach. But you can offer classics in one school and allow the pupils from the other school to go to that school if they want to do it. But you have to cooperate. We got rid of the 11 plus, not because of some working class movement, but because the middle class had run out of money to pay for private schools in the 1960s. And they knew their children could fail the 11 plus, and they didn't have the escape route to put them in a private school when they did fail. So the middle class led the movement for comprehensives. So when we ran out of money, the middle class did the same with the NHS. We got an NHS in 1948, because in the 1930s the middle class could no longer afford a private doctor. You have to take the middle class on board if you're going to get educational reform. Otherwise you get educational reform for other people's children. You get the Labour Academy programme. Nice new school for poor kids' children. That's what it was. Very well-meaning. Wasn't for their children. You need a reform which is for all our children. And that means moving towards cooperation. How do you begin to do it? You do it when you run out of money. And luckily we are running out of money big time. And that's how we got the health service. That's how we got the comprehensive schools. It's running out of money. In a town like Oxford, where I live and where I grew up, we have half a dozen secondary state schools, all academies now. They already, by the way, impose selection at age 16. In the ones in the posh part of town, if you don't get enough GCSEs at high enough grades, you're kicked out. Which means the children from the working class estates are kicked out at 16 from the state schools in Oxford. It's already bad and it's already happening. We've also got half a dozen large senior management teams. Why do you need half a dozen large senior management teams? Why not just have, well, I'll get there in the end, but start with two schools with very similar results near to each other, and you're running out of money. And we know we're cutting the funding massively for children at 16, 17, 18 in our schools. We're about to see the most incredible cuts for primary schools and then the urban area coming in the next few months. So merge the senior management teams, just have one. You can keep the names of the two sites of the schools, but run them as one school. Move the teachers between them, so you don't just have all the very young and keen, but completely new first teachers in the poorer area, and the teachers in their 30s, and the occasional teacher of a child in the posh area. You can begin to move their teachers between them, but also you can begin to move pupils between the sites. Now, I say, we've got half a dozen schools in Oxford. Eventually, you can have one senior management team. You can call it the Oxford University Grammar Academy Specialist School. I don't care. I don't care what you call the thing. You have the same sites. Educational reform has always used exactly the same sites and buildings as we change things. You do it slowly because teachers have had enough reforms that are fast. But you move towards cooperation, the sharing of resources and buildings between sites. And as you do that, you get rid of selection by house price, because what's the point of spending £200,000 more to live in one area if children from an area that's cheaper can move towards your sites, and if you're not going to get the older and more experienced teachers? And if you do it really well, you do it really well, and that will eventually involve a target, an aspirational target of spending per child the same as the Western European average. If you do it really well, then those upper middle class families who are paying for their children to fail selection exams and to be educated outside of the state system will begin to come into your state system. And that's not utopian. When I went to school in Oxford, I'd have been 10 times more likely to go to university if I'd gone private rather than state. Now in Oxford, the difference is 20-30% higher. It's tiny. What are you doing sending your child to a private school in Oxford? It's because you're thinking of the chances for your generation. Your child can get to a Russell Group University from state or private. We are getting very close to it not mattering. Of course, if you send your child to an elite private school in Oxford, they are more likely to get into Oxford or Cambridge. But if you set that aspiration for them, they will almost certainly fail. So you're paying money to set your children up to tell them they are not good enough. I think there's enormous scope for things to get better, but we can't just defend comprehensive schools. We need to argue for cooperative schools. We need to say, oh, there are already 800. It is possible you move towards it slowly, and one day our 24-year-old adults might not be at the bottom of the European league table for ability, including the ability of those with free A's, as well as the ability of those who fail everything. Because our kids with free A's are not that imaginative, they're not that clever, they're just bloody good at learning an exam script and writing exactly what they need to write to get the A. And if the world in future required a country to specialise in the ability to pass exams, we'd be doing the right thing. But the world doesn't need people who can pass exams. The world needs people who know many things, who can learn, who are adaptable, and who don't just do what they're told. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Danny. And now over to you. Welcome questions from anyone. I'm going to say it's fine to make a contribution or to ask a question, but maybe keep it fairly short just to let as many people as possible participate. I can see a woman back with glasses.
That statistic about the attainment difference in regards to state schools alongside ethnicity, I was interested on your thoughts on why that exists, because I think it could be seized on by the extreme right, basically, some kind of inherent biological difference. So I'm trying to make race a biological issue rather than a physical one. And also in regards to the delivery of it was broached by Holly and in regards to how education is delivered, the education specialist Sir Ken Robinson speaks about how this very structure of it is a throwback to the Industrial Revolution. So children are sort of herded in by age, and it's a reflection of the factory, the way things were categorised in factories. So it's, in regards, I think this is a good time, as we have this grammar school today, to look at how education is delivered, so as well as content. Is the system too rigid? Does it tend to circumscribe how people think, and children who may not be naturally academic? I mean, the fact is academia is almost like an end in itself, and it may not, it's a straitjacket in some ways, it kind of streamlines people, people may fall into that so easily. So is this the time to kind of look at how to not just improve what we have, as you said, Danny, but to also deliver slightly differently, or at least broaden it in a way that some people who may not be particularly mathematically minded don't go through life thinking they're a dunce and they're a failure because they didn't,
Brilliant, thank you. I'll take a couple more and then we can say, gentlemen, navy jumper.
Hi, Ollie. I think your speech was really good. I've been to your school, and everywhere it's talking about the only place you should go after you finish it is university.
Yeah.
That's what it's sold to. And the woman that started your school is now going to be the head of Ofsted. Mm-hmm. She's never taught a day in her life. And the Education Select Committee said that she should not be the head of Ofsted. She has no understanding of job protection, social services. But that was overruled. And so we're going to get a lot more schools like you. Interesting, you're also involved in teacher training, and you've still got a year, I think, before you can quit, before the 5 years. There's 50% of teachers that don't teach first quit within 5 years. You've got a year to go, and then you won't get that bracket. And what Teach First is about is getting a certain class of people to teach our children, usually white, who have gone to Oxbridge, that, as you say, can churn out stuff, but have no understanding of things such as pedagogy, which you said, I don't know if you just but also to do child protection, special needs. They don't look like the people they teach, they don't sound like them, and they don't understand them at all. But I also want to think about the inequality that exists within our profession, because I teach in a school in Hackney, and I was the first person to go to university in my family, and I don't look like all of the kids I teach, but I understand exactly what they do. But the inequality in my school exists in an art profession. So, for example, in my school, Hackney School, we don't offer any. There's no. If you're sick for the first year, you get no sick pay. After the second year, you get 2 weeks. We are in probation for a year before you're on a permanent contract. We're not allowed to order things without permission. We're a music specialist school, so all the kids do get really into music, but the focus is on getting another school across the road. And what Danny talks about, this notion of, I think the grammar school thing is about choice. That's what they say, it's about choice. We have lots of choice. We have federations, we have academies, we have free schools. So it's bullshit that parents, I had a parents' evening a few weeks ago, open evening, and the parents were talking about what can you give my kid. They were talking about what can we give our kids in Hackney, in Islington. So I don't buy this stuff around corporations. That's not what it's about. It's about dividing. So lots and lots of competition between schools. And you're right about league tables. That's when it really began. So I'll finish quickly, but we need to think about the inequality that exists within our the teachers themselves. I can't afford to buy a place in London. My rent is 60% of my pay. 60%. I get £2,500, and £1,300 of that goes straight on rent each month. I can't afford to buy, to save, and to stay in the area. So what do we get? We get parents of rich kids teaching our kids that have no understanding of our students. So I look forward to your documentary, and the work that you do for us is brilliant. I had a go at Tim because I didn't like the way he spoke about Jeremy Corbyn, and I agree with you. I joined the Labour Party because I believe he is not harking back to the 1970s. Labour talk about the vision, the next vision, which is a comprehensive system where schools all cooperate. We can work with other schools in our area, but what happens is you get rid of management, okay, and they earn loads of money at ARC, £300,000 each, okay, and the pay of people like me, 1% next year, 1% the year after, 1% the year after, that's what my pay will increase. But the head of ARC is getting £350,000 a year, he's getting a nice free limo that drives.
I'm going to cut you off so you can get someone else in. Thank you. Woman at the back with the wonderful glasses.
Just to put it in another direction, I'm the chair of the Multi-Academy Trust in Coventry. And I'm just very interested in what Danny was saying about cooperation, because our trust is 5 schools, and we've actually become, it's an organic thing. It's people come to us because they want to be part of our Multi-Academy Trust. What we're trying to do in Coventry is to actually produce a voluntary agreement amongst all of our schools that we don't increase the numbers in one school, which would be at the expense of another. And all our secondary academies have signed up to that now. I think it's a really, really positive thing to take forward. We've got to be where we are now. We have to go forward in terms of the progression. And I think you're absolutely right. We need to cooperate far more. And I'd like us, as our school, to actually build much more of other schools rather than schools to be developed in the same way.
Brilliant. And who else? Just raise your hand up high because I know how many more questions are up. Okay, we've only got 2 more, so I'll go to you at the front, sir, and then you at the back.
Yeah, I started teaching in 73. I retired a few years ago now. And one of the things I find which is pernicious is faith schools, which yes. I believe are dividing our society. apart from other things like free schools and stuff. And we really should get away from this. I mean, I'm not of a Christian background, but I don't want Sikh schools, Hindu schools, Muslim schools, you name it, CV, whatever. And I went to CV primary school when I was young. But they are destructive, and they are one of the ways that our society is getting divided into little groups and so on. And we should, as a Labour Party, be working against that. Mm. I won't say more, there are many other things that could come with them, but that is particularly important, I think, for the future.
Mm.
I would just like to merge these 2 other points. Oh, where's it gone? I teach in just outside Morecambe. I worked in Morecambe for 9 years, obviously, in a broken arm. I parked back to the 2003 when I jumped in a plane with 40 quid in my pocket to come here to teach because the adverts were constantly on TV. Get into teaching and all that sort of groaning out of it. But it was brilliant, it was a great job. And then the Conservatives came along. And yes, Labour has started the academies process, but the academies we have now are a lot, lot different to what they were under Tony Blair. My school has just recently started the proceed for this, started to move towards decarbonisation. I'm hoping that they're going to run out of the organic model that you talked about. But I want to know what impact that's going to have on me, because in our area, I would love to say it's probably not love to say. I would say it's the most competitive anywhere in the country. We've got two grammar schools, the boys and the girls' grammar school. And around that, we've got lots of other schools that try and be second best. Sorry, third best, because we've got faith school in there as well, which for many faith schools, they select by faith. So we're all vying for fourth place. So it's very, very difficult to have that organic, cooperative model in Lancaster and Morecambe when you've got two grammars, the faith school, yeah, and four or five other seismic or quite sizable secondary school pitching for that fourth spot. We've set up an academy process with that third school. So I'm sat there thinking, I don't really want to answer the faith route. We've been told, no, we can keep our own little non-faith school. They can keep their faith school. But to what extent can I protect my working interests? Because you said there's an academy gene just up the road that's got rid of fraternity fair, it's got rid of sick fair, and I don't want me jumping on board in an academy chain that can have the same impact upon me. I actually don't mind the academy process because they're most spread out. It's left, gone. I don't mind it. But what I want is I want a nice academy, not screw you over academy. That's what I want. So to what extent can that exist in a marketplace where I live and teach that is awful in terms of money?
Thank you. Danny's really keen to answer that one.
I'd like to answer that one again. I should say, by the way, if everybody went to university, the country would collapse. I mean, that's, you know, and of course, other European countries, it is absolutely fine not to go to university. Fewer people do, it's free to go, and people who don't go are respected, and their pay is not many times less. Thomas Hardy School in Dorchester. About two decades ago, it was a boys' grammar, a girls' grammar, and two other schools. Luckily, they're near to each other. It is one school, well over 2,000 pupils. Dorchester has one school. Parents love it because it's one school. You worry, oh, this is massive. It has separate areas of the school for children of different ages. So the children do not think they're in a massive school, but the teachers can be moved around the site, so it's a single school with a single management. That's, and it works in that area. You'll never solve this if you have separate private institutions, whether they say they cooperate or not. And there are these horrible things where very posh schools pretend they help a poor school, not realising that what they really need is help from the poor school coming the other way. Saying, if somebody makes you do your homework to 10 o'clock every night and wear a weird uniform, you can call social services. Because children in poor schools know about social services and children. Anyway, I won't get myself. I would just say, look for examples, places like Dorchester, where there already is genuine cooperation. Genuine cooperation means you are employed by the same body. You know, it's not pretend. And it's possible to do it. And over management of these things, I wrote a piece about a year ago on this. I think we have to move slowly. We've got to move away. The one problem with academies is the management. 8 trustees, often 4 of whom are directors of companies, as far as I can see, largely set up to allow them to avoid paying tax. They get really upset when I say that. But the nice thing is academy trustees have to declare their directorship of companies, and you've got to ask, why haven't they got any employees and it's just him and her? And I know I could do this and avoid paying tax as well. The problem is the management of academies. It's worthies doing it for other people's children. They don't send their children to the academy very often. So you're going to need a new management model eventually, a new model of governing. And again, look to the rest of Europe for how it's done. But why not have a model of governing in the future, which, of course, we've just managed to keep parent governors on only just, but has teachers on the governing body, many teachers, and gives the governing body the ability to sack the head, which they can do, and has children on as well, students on. This may sound utopian. Of course, it exists in other parts of Europe. But it's also the management model for my university. That's what a governing body of an Oxford college is. It's the teachers. We own it. And it works. It's worked for 800 years. And the governing body of a university is a council, which consists of a majority of university members of staff who can and have sacked the vice-chancellor. It's an incredibly effective model of management. And if it was good enough for Oxford University, why not think eventually of moving towards that? Rather than being governed by your betters, which is the current academy model, we must have accountants in charge, and we'll have one regional commissioner who could look into them if they seem to be particularly dodgy. But we're going to run out of money to afford academies because of the £300,000 salaries and the rest. And it's when we run out of money that new things become much more possible than they were.
Thanks, Danny. I think this is the first time I've felt optimistic about the fact that money's running out in the UK. So I'm going to go to Holly and Visor to wrap up. We've had so much sort of schools as factories, cooperation in common theory, race and faith, and inequalities within the teaching profession. So I'm just going to say, sort of pick up the things you're most interested in and wrap up with your summary thoughts.
So just to address a couple of points, kind of leading on from what Danny said, I think that, and the lady there who works in the multi-academy trust, I think what's happened with some multi-academy trusts, like ARC, I'm not here to sell the ARC, like, you know, mission or whatever, but actually working in my school, what we have seen is that the ARC schools do all cooperate with each other, so there's been rapid changes to GCSE curriculum in the last 2 years that have been so hard to manage, and because of cooperation, that means that burden has been shared between schools. So there are some kind of like quite well-functioning multi-academy trusts that do cooperate and then therefore do get best outcomes for their students. But the point is that the market-driven ideology of academies as a concept doesn't really lend itself to that. So I would argue that ARC is kind of like the good, and other schools like it, kind of the good apple in a bit of a rotten barrel. And so I wouldn't necessarily say that I think that more academies should be brought into practice. And addressing your point about the teaching profession, I didn't really talk about all the problems actually being a teacher and what that looks like. We have now the highest turnover rate of any like Western European country. Most teachers not just teach first ones, leave within the first 5 years. You know, in my school, the first year we had 50% of teachers leave. We have roughly 30 teachers leave every year. In a staff of 120, for young people who've already got very chaotic home lives, like that has a massive effect. And I think that we need to, a lot of the time now what's happening is like my school is focusing on well-being, so we have like mindfulness sessions and, you know, like afternoon tea and like all these things, and it's great and the people who do it are really well-meaning, but we need good union organising. That's what we need. Like, we need good union organising so that our workloads aren't so large, that our pay isn't remaining so stagnant. And I think that all this stuff around well-being is kind of like obscuring it. And I think that academies generally, I mean, there is no union organisation in my school. Like, the first year I was there, they kicked out the 50 unionised members of staff, either made them redundant, made their work lives like unbearable so they couldn't stay there. That is the ARC story as well. Like, you know, there are two sides to that story, and I just think, yeah, heavier unionisation could solve some of those things. Just finally on children like not being naturally academic, I get that, definitely. You know, there are what I want is for young people to have choice, to be able to choose what they're able to do, to be able to find their passions and find what they're good at. My problem is that often it's always our working class children that we push into apprenticeships. Like, it's never the middle class children who are going to do apprenticeships, right? So sometimes I feel like, you know, yes, apprenticeships, yes, we need a system more like in Europe where actually in society apprenticeships are put on the same level as a university education. But I want every child in my school, like, you know, taking other things into account, special needs, I want them to be able to read a newspaper, like a broadsheet newspaper cover to cover, like, and that level of literacy, that's not that easy to achieve, like, particularly like in schools like mine. So I think, yes, we want children to have options, we want children to follow their passions, but let's not be unashamed in saying that we also want them to have a really rigorous education and that they leave with, you know, some really, really good standards, I think, particularly in literacy, which is a big problem across the UK generally now. So, yeah.
Thanks. And Pfizer, you're going to have the last word.
Great. All day. Thank you so much. I've just been so inspired by what I've heard, and it's interesting. You enter a topic on schools and you end up talking about housing, you end up talking about, you know, all these interconnected issues, and you also end up thinking about some of the underlying ideologies that persist. I'm sure in every session we'd go in today, you know, parallel or otherwise, you'll hear again the damage that competition is doing, right? And I think that is really important, that underlying ideology. So when we think about ways forward, we think about those root causes and the ideology that we need to attack. On this really important question on the race gap, like we, when we did that documentary, I'm just waiting. Next week I have to live tweet the program, and I'm just going to get so many trolls. I know I will, just saying that, like, essentially, oh, that's because black people don't work as hard, and all the rest of the rubbish that you will hear when you talk about those disparities. During the show, we're very careful to talk about the disparities that start from day one, so the levels of poverty that start, because if you're in particular, if you have a Muslim name or you're black, you're less likely to be employed. So your child is more likely to be poor. This vicious cycle. So we try and lay it out that way. You know, I think that was a really important point that Paul made this morning, that with some people that are going to think that, what can you do? They're idiots. And, you know, but there's a lot of people that will watch that show, and there's some really damning evidence. I don't want to give the whole thing away, but, like, there's some really striking things that really even shocked me. A lot of people will think, like, wow, this is not right, you know. And the answer can't be grammar schools. We need to be out there. Actually, maybe Holly and I should have a chat about what comment pieces we write to make sure that that show is followed up, not with the answer to this is grammar school, the answer to this is, you know, something different. Completely agree with Danny's point about not just defending a system, and I think we've just got so caught up in firefighting, we're constantly defending, we've got to think about that vision. For me, that vision, and just tying it to faith schools, I really hate faith schools. I did a project when I was 22 or something with Save the Children, when we went out and spoke to kids going to different types of faith schools. And the day I didn't go, they went to a Catholic school. And they said, oh, the kids were saying that multiculturalism doesn't work. We have to be in this school, don't we? Because they won't accept us elsewhere. And we heard that again and again. We went to a Muslim school and the kids were saying, oh, but outside they won't accept my religion. And as well as dividing people, dividing our kids into these groups, it makes them feel like no one will accept them outside. Now, we went to, I say we because my sister said, but we went to a school where we did have to make people understand what fasting was, that we were Muslim, that, you know, and honestly, yeah, sure, there was people that would like, say really ignorant things, but they learn. They're a part of me, I'm a part of them. They go forward in life. Like, for me, the vision of our education system is certainly one of attainment. That important part about mixing and knowing there's good and bad in all of us, that is so fundamental to the society we want to see. So definite no to faith schools, and how we can try and encourage that mixing as much as possible from day one. Because really, the next generation is already showing that they don't accept these racist views, and I really do think it's something to do with that, that we know each other, we love each other. Finally, just on this point about just thinking about what happens in London and schools, and this point that's come up very strongly about the need for cooperation among schools. The schools, I think it was, if I understand the story right, like a head teacher decided to reach out to other schools, wasn't waiting for government policy, sort of decided to do something. Now, I'd be really interested in how schools are disrupting, are ignoring some of the things that are coming out, and they are reaching out, and they are saying they're fed up of this. And how you, this, I know there's several teachers here, some that haven't spoken, but, you know, how we can make that happen is you know, without, in the current state of things, we have to start that action. And I'd be really excited to hear about some of that stuff that's happened. Do get in touch with us. But thank you. And thank you especially to the speakers that have been amazing.
Yeah, brilliant. So I think everyone give everyone a round of applause.